This is Ozarks at Large. Adam Vines' poetry mixes language and the natural world. His first collection of poems, The Coal Life, was published by the University of Arkansas Press. Adam Vines is assistant professor of English at the University of Alabama, Birmingham. Recently, he read at Nightbird Books as a guest of the Ozark Poets and Writers Collective. The morning after that reading, he talked with Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums.
Seems like even when I'm inside, I'm looking outside. My poems that start out on the inside, there's always an open window, or there's always a plant. There's always something that's drawing me back to the natural world. And that's because I've spent probably more time, more waking hours in the natural world than I have inside or in the man-made world.
When you were a professional landscaper, were you coming up with lines and observations that you would put down?
I was, yeah. It's a very different kind of writing when you're outside. And living in Birmingham, I couldn't carry a piece of paper and a pad and a pen with me because I'm just so sweaty. I tried to do that a few times, and I'm just dripping everywhere, and, you know, it's a mess. So I started thinking about lines in my head and constructing lines and images in my head, and I did a lot of my writing in my head. And then when I would get home, I could sit down, and I was excited about writing, which is different from being involved with language all day long. Sometimes you burn out if you're grading all day, and the last thing you want to do is approach language. I want to go outside and get my maul and my chainsaw and cut wood, you know?
Right.
It's like the landscaper whose yard looks awful. You know, you come home,
Busman's
the last
holiday,
thing you want
right?
to do. Yeah. But... yeah, the landscape is and the natural world always, and there's always a body of water in some way. I'm always going back to the river or going back to the bay.
Or rain.
Or rain, sure.
Your poem, Burying the Dead.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I was the only weird kid who would bury the little army men or cowboys and Indians. You did too.
I did. That's an autobiographical poem. And I actually went back, when I wrote that poem, I went back to my childhood home and asked the people if I could go in the backyard, and I found a cowboy and an Indian and a bunch of army men that were still deep underground, you know, in this one area that didn't have a lot of wash, and they thought I was crazy when I asked, but it was right next to Trinity Church, and you know, all of that, the environment for the poem is spot on. And my mother asking me to come in and all of that, I actually, you know, asked her about what I was like. And she said, you used to do that constantly.
And you mentioned in the poem, you wave her off as your father might.
Right.
How do you, and the observation of looking across the street and seeing your father and hearing his hammer and the nails clinking. Mm-hmm. How do you get to the point where you remember that? Because so many of us, when approached with something from our past by another person, go, oh, that's right, but we would never think of that on our own.
I think that some of it is memory, and I think some of it is just observation over the years that's kind of infiltrated into that memory. I think that it's true. It's all plausible. It may not have been in that one experience when it's raining that one day for that one poem, but, you know, when I was in the backyard hearing my father coming home, it may have been another day, but this was a combination, a marriage of experiences that creates a small poem like this. This poem is also a recurring dream that I had.
Really?
Yeah. I had it up until my daughter. I haven't had it since my daughter was born, but I had it after my father died when I was 19, probably 5, 6, 7 times, and I would wake up in a panic. What I don't have in the end of the poem, which I have in the end of the dream, is I'm walking around the church trying to catch up to him, and I can't catch up to him. And in the end, he's at a playground pushing another child on a swing, and he doesn't know me. So it's as if he has a different life and a different child. And I guess that's part of that separation anxiety that I find more and more in the book, that just happened unconsciously, the separation of father and son, whether it's through religion or physically in the poems, with the coal miners, you know, the father who's the coal miner and the child who's at home.
There is the poem Threat of Spring,
mm-hmm.
about the father who's a coal miner and washing, getting the coal dust off. It's a very vivid poem, And I am guessing you labored over the exact words in that poem.
Oh, yes.
Because none of them are wrong. Mm-mm. They're all, and none of them are only okay. They're all exactly right.
Well, thanks. Yeah.
How do you do, I mean, sweat?
Sweat. I mean, it's writing is labor. It's blue-collar work, and I tell my students that. I have it on my syllabus. I say writing is hard work. It's blue-collar work. I had a mentor who was a Beowulf scholar, and toward the end of his life, he took on the task of writing his Beowulf translation, which, you know, all scholars end up doing. Sadly, he wrote his right after Seamus Heaney wrote his.
Oh, well, there you go.
So, of course, but it's true to the prosody. It's a fantastic representation. And I remember talking to him when he was very sick and trying to finish it up when I was in Florida. I said, "What are you doing, Steve?" And he said, "I'm hammering out half lines." And I thought the idea of that labor at the forge, hammering out these half lines. And I started thinking about it, and that's kind of what I do in my poetry, too. I feel like it's not about sitting down and being inspired. And, you know, it really is. It's about, with me, it's hard work. It's coming up with the language that perfectly represents the experience.
Is the right word for you, the author? The right word for me, the reader?
I think I'm thinking of both of them, because the problem is I could become too esoteric where I lose my readership, and I've got to be careful with that. You want language that's evocative, and you want language that perhaps give people a vision of something that they've seen every day in a fresh manner, but you don't want to use language that they're so unfamiliar with that they give up and they're not going to look it up, or it's too Latinate and it's clunky and it's gate. But I love the language of coal mining. I love that esoteric language of fishing, you know, of industries. I think that what I love poetry that brings in language from other disciplines and then brings it into the poem instead of poetic language.
There are a couple of people with the name Williams that are now attached to your bio forever.
Yeah.
You're a Tennessee Williams scholar at Sewanee,
right.
A finalist for the Miller Williams Poetry Prize. Those are two nice names to have hanging around.
It's
your
beautiful.
Own.
I mean, it's, yeah, I don't deserve it, that's for sure. But, no, I love the idea of being tied to both of those great writers and great Southern writers. Again, I'm older, but I'm just a kid starting out. You know, this is my first collection. I haven't been writing seriously for that many years. I'm really just kind of starting my teaching career, and I'm still, I don't even know where I'm going to go with my second collection yet. You know, I'm writing to it, I guess, but I'm not sure where I'm going yet.
You teach.
I do.
One of the most interesting and most disturbing things on the web is ratemyprofessor.com. However, I have to mention, and I wasn't stalking, this is preparing, but universally, the comments about your teaching mention passion and wanting to, because I am imagining you're not just teaching English majors or
no,
you're teaching a general population. All the comments are about this apparent desire to share your love of the language with all the students. It appears that you like to teach.
I do. I adore teaching. I had wonderful mentors. I changed majors two or three times. Like I said, I wasn't taking classes to get a practical degree where I would go out into the workforce. I was just intrigued with knowledge. And I had two professors in particular, Jim Mersman and Bob Collins, who encouraged me to write. And they had that kind of, I mean, you walked in their class and they were so excited, they were beating on the desk, you know, and I get that way sometimes. I had a class two classes ago where I was talking about James Merrill, and I read The Doodler, and I was reading parts of it, and I just couldn't contain myself, and I just started wailing. I had the book, and I was doing this, and, you know, beating it on the desk, and everybody's eyes are huge, and they're, you know, they think I'm a madman, and I am a madman when it comes to this. Another thing, I worked full-time, and I work at a university that's turning into more of a traditional university, but we still have quite a few working students. We have quite a few first-year or first-generation college students. I think that I understand them maybe more. I'm not a bow-tie-wearing professor. You know, I'm a guy who comes in with bloody hands because I've been out doing stuff before class. You know, I got dirt under my fingernails because I put my hands in the soil. And I think when I talk about hard work and I talk about these poems and I talk about the experience in the poems, that they trust me. And I think that we make a connection in that way. And I truly do believe that in a mentorship where I'm not merely someone who is above the class and gives grades. I'm someone who's there to encourage. I wish I didn't have to give grades. I wish that we could just rely on everyone coming in with integrity and everyone working hard and just support systems that evolved out of that. But I do have to give grades.
Another thing that you do at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, is you're the advisor to the UAB fishing team, correct?
I am.
Because you love to fish.
Because I love to fish. I had some students who approached me 5 or 6 years ago about starting a team. And I didn't even know about university fishing teams. You know, if I would have had one when I was, no telling where I would have ended up. But they approached me, and of course I said I would do it. I didn't have a lot of time. My old position I had at UAB, I taught a 4-4, so 4 classes a semester and a lot of lower-level teaching, which I love, but it's intensive. And I said I would do it, and that first year we won the region and did extremely against teams that had won national championships, Auburn and Alabama. The next year, we had a team that placed 7th in the nation out of 160 teams. So we've done pretty well, especially because we have kids who they're not wealthy and they don't come in with a 21-foot boat and they don't have the money to travel to Texas and to drive a boat to Texas to compete. So they have to be really choosy in the tournaments that they fish. And again, many of these students are working full-time, and the university sadly isn't able to support them at all.
The U of A, the University of Birmingham bass fishing team, has done very well.
They've done extremely well. Yeah, I just saw some results. I think that they're in the top rankings right now. But, yeah, it's exciting. And another thing, these students, if you're a fisherman or a fisherwoman, and luckily we've had 2 women on the team, and that's been fantastic, you have to get up very early in the morning. So, you know, the Thursday night going out, these students can't do that. Or you can't get up on Friday and fish. Or you can't get up on Friday and do a practice day. So I think that, there's something about keeping them out of the bars and keeping them on the water, which I like too. Keeping them in the natural world. I think that it's better for their academic studies, too. I think that it's nourishing to the mind to be out there in a kind of Thoreauvian sense.
The collection is called The Coal Life. It's published by the University of Arkansas Press. There's one more poem I want to ask you about that I found online that's not in there.
Sure.
And it's The Golden Years.
Yeah.
I love this poem.
I read it last night, actually. Yeah. It's a pantoum, which is a Malaysian form, a repeating form. And was me thinking about, getting older and, the term golden years, how, you reach your golden years. And I'm not sure how golden they are, really. Maybe it's a little pessimistic in what it's doing. But at the same time, I hope that there's a sweetness that comes through.
There is.
Where, you're using the same lines, but the I said and the placement of the I said. You have one person who's talking to another person who may be going through a bit of dementia. And this mate gets a little frustrated, but in the end, I think that there's a kind of a wonderful connection that happens, where I'm going to take care of you now instead of, God, here we are, and you're getting old, and, you're sick, and, this is how I'm going to have to spend the rest of my years. And I'm hoping that it's my wife's in much better shape than I am, and she's younger, so maybe that's me projecting a bit, too.
Well, it's a wonderful poem because you read it more than once. You finish it, and you're not quite sure what happened, and so you go back.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean that in a it's hard to decipher.
Right.
But it takes that second reading to, I see.
Yeah, that's a poem that I'm hoping is going to shape this next collection. A lot of my poems in this next collection are more autobiographical, and I think that this one is more me, and my anxieties. Though my anxieties are always projected or transferred onto the personae that I assume, here I think that's much more closely related to my own fears at 43. I was telling my students, once you reach 40 or so, it's no longer, it's what you have left instead of, you know, and I'm not being pessimistic about that. I was just being practical, you know, I'm probably not going to live to be twice as old as I am.
You begin to think about these things that the first day of spring or a Christmas Eve, it's like
you do.
You can start figuring out that there are only so many to go. And
why
I know
not, yeah.
that right now someone 25 years older than us is just laughing at us,
of
right?
Of course, of course. And I know how ridiculous it is, you know. And my mother kind of tells me that, you know. She's going on 70 and she's enjoying herself more than she's ever enjoyed herself, I think, especially having grandkids. And, you know, she's not scared of what's to come. And I'm not scared either, but it's funny to think that you're over that edge, though. You're counting down instead of counting up,
right.
Maybe.
The Cole Life, published by the University of Arkansas Press. It's available anywhere online. It's also locally here at the University of Arkansas bookstores, Nightbird Books. Adam Vines, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Adam Vines' first collection of poetry is titled The Cole Life, published by the University of Arkansas Press. He was in Fayetteville earlier this month as a guest of the Ozark Poets and Writers Collective. He is assistant professor of English at the University of Alabama, Birmingham. He talked to Ozark's at-large's Kyle Kellums earlier this month during his visit. The next Ozark Poets and Writers featured writer is Jeff Olsner. He'll be at Nightbird Books in Fayetteville on Tuesday, January 29th.